Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On today's show, we continue our week-long series on the climate crisis. Tomorrow, over 1 million young people are taking to the streets, or actually, I should say, they're expected to take to the streets around the globe to demand action on this crisis. The Global Climate Strike website says, "The climate crisis is an emergency. We want everyone to start acting like it. We demand climate justice for all. Our hotter planet is already hurting millions of people. If we don't act now to transition fairly and swiftly away from fossil fuels to 100% renewable energy, the injustice of the crisis will only get worse. We need to act right now to stop burning fossil fuels and ensure a rapid energy revolution with equity, reparations, and climate justice at its heart." So on today's Your Call, we are talking about climate justice with people on the front lines. Michael Estrada is organizing director at Green for All, an Oakland-based community organization that's fighting to build an inclusive green economy while creating green jobs for people living in poverty. At Green for All, Michael has been working on the National Fuel Change Campaign, which is advocating for zero-emission electric cars, trucks, and buses in underserved neighborhoods. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the show.
Hey there. How you doing?
Good. Thank
you for joining, y'all.
It's great to have you. Thank you. We're also joined by Gladys Limon, an executive director at the California Environmental Justice Alliance, a statewide community-led alliance that works to achieve environmental justice by advancing policy solutions. Gladys also helped lead the work on the Standing Together Against Neighborhood Drilling Coalition and ushered the fight to defeat the Puente power plant in Oxnard, California. Hi, Gladys. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you.
Well, I want to start with both of you on a positive note, because I have to say the last three shows we've done have been pretty heavy, like this issue. I mean, we talked about Hurricane Dorian and how that really showed us just the massive inequality and how this hits the poor so hard. We talked about air pollution and many other issues. So I want to start off by talking with you both just about how far we've come. And when you think about the possibility of over 1 million young people around the globe taking to the streets tomorrow, I read that some schools in New York are saying, if you want to strike, that's fine. So, Gladys, what are your thoughts just about all of the energy we're seeing around these issues?
Well, the communities that are at the front lines of fossil fuel operations and other polluting sources have really risen to leadership over the years. They have been demanding for improvements to our environmental policies to protect the health and safety of their families. And it is largely due to their leadership that we now have state and other leaders who are making efforts to rise to that occasion. And we're at a critical time. It's an exciting time in which the youth are speaking now with wiser words than adults and those elected officials. While we've made some gains, particularly in California, we have some ambitious renewable energy goals, for example. There is still a ton to do, and we need transformative policies that center equity and justice in them.
What would you add, Michael?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing to add on to that is just folks, especially young people, have seen oftentimes the government at large may be acting slower or not at all on issues that are really important to them. And I think as we're seeing more and more of the science coming out showing that our timeline for making some of these drastic changes is so short, I think it's essentially this sort of burning platform where people are like, now is the time that we need to make these changes. And I think with the energy coming up from especially young people and like you mentioned, folks that were on the front lines seeing these impacts every single day in a very real way, I think it's amazing to see them moving into those spaces and being able to see folks accept them and sort of uplift them and hold those voices up.
And Gladys, you make a great point about how young people and people of color, people on the front lines, are really educating politicians, especially because yesterday a number of youth testified on Capitol Hill, and it was kind of amazing watching these young people in some ways, many ways, school these politicians, especially the Republicans who just went on and on and on about how much they love capitalism. It was kind of surreal, actually, to watch. So can you talk more about that? The youth are just really at the forefront of this movement right now, especially youth on the front lines.
Yes, well, those at the forefront are those that have the most to risk, the most to lose, and those that have been sacrificed. So communities of color and low-income communities that have been targeted by industry and citing these polluting sources, including greenhouse gas emitters, they are the ones who are currently suffering from respiratory illnesses, living in cancer, toxic hotspots, and a host of other impacts to their health and safety. And of course, now the youth, they understand that they are inheriting a tremendous problem, a real crisis that puts, it's an existential crisis that puts our ability to survive as a species, you know, on the line. We're not talking about, you know, saving the planet. We're talking about saving our future generations. And, you know, efforts and policies to reduce greenhouse gas emissions at the statewide level and even at national level have tended to have a few flawed approaches that, you know, ignore the real urgency. One, they look at the aggregate issues and numbers and neglect the local place-based needs of communities at the front lines of emissions and deadly air pollution. They're largely market-based emissions offset schemes that are largely ineffective, have been proven ineffective. And they also neglect to meaningfully consider and respect those communities, again, who are the most impacted and who have valuable expertise and experience to offer in crafting solutions. And again, those are indigenous communities and those at the front lines of fossil fuel and other greenhouse gas emitters, and now the younger generations.
Can you talk more about market-based offsets? Because we hear a lot about this, and I'd like to do a show about this. I think we need to go deeper into that to explain exactly how this works and what the data tells us, especially about the market-based offsets that have already been implemented.
Mm-hmm. Well, first, you know, there are very common sense and basic, simple solutions to reducing greenhouse gas emissions, and that is that you just have direct regulations. You cut emissions at the source, you know, at refineries, for example. You place limits there. But what California and other jurisdictions have are these markets essentially commodifying pollution and greenhouse gas emissions to allow those polluters and largely bad actors to simply continue to pollute and in many cases increase their greenhouse gas emissions and pollution by buying offsets that many times in these schemes, sort of like a casino marketplace, are imaginary. They're made up. They're on paper, but they're not actually real. And that is one of many of the criticisms of these sorts of schemes, is that they don't result in real emissions. They're very difficult to track and monitor to ensure their integrity.
That is Gladys Limon, Executive Director of the California Environmental Justice Alliance. We're also joined by Michael Estrada, Organizing Director at Green for All, an Oakland-based community organization that's fighting to build an inclusive green economy. We're going to talk about what is happening in Sacramento, but before we do that, in our last couple of shows about, we talked about air pollution and we talked about the food system. I really want to spend some time on solutions because a lot of these issues, I think, to people are kind of overwhelming. And when we had Michael Mann on, who's a climate scientist, he said what some of these climate enablers are doing, the big groups that are funding, front groups for Shell and Exxon and Chevron, for example, what they're trying to do now is to put out a campaign to basically make people believe that it is so overwhelming and we cannot take action. It's just out of our hands at this point. And I thought that was a really important thing to discuss. So given that, let's talk about some solutions. Michael, you're all working on the National Fuel Change Campaign, which is advocating for zero emission electric cars, trucks, and buses to underserved neighborhoods. Can you tell us more about that and then some other solutions that are at the top of your list?
Yeah.
So the main campaign that we're running, like you said, is called Fuel Change. And what we're looking to do, particularly at this point in the campaign, is focusing on electric school buses and how we can bring those to the communities that are often impacted most by some of the transit pollution issues. I mean, we know that transit pollution is the number one greenhouse gas emitting sector in the U.S. And so looking at school buses, it's a quality of life issue where we have children that are on these buses daily. We have the buses driving through neighborhoods, often depots idling, and we know that the effects are often worse for children and for older folks. And so with the Fuel Change campaign, they're actually on Monday are launching a community action toolkit, which is a way for community members to, one, have some issue education so they could learn a little bit more about the diesel buses that are currently serving the road, and the benefits of transitioning to electric school buses. And two, it'll give them a step-by-step guide on how they can connect with their local school districts to help start spurring on this change. One of the main issues that we see with electric vehicles, or electric school buses in particular, is that there's quite a high cost up front to purchase an electric school bus versus a traditional diesel bus. But like we see with many of these green solutions, right, the folks who have the resources up front to pay for solar panels or who are able to cover these costs often reap the benefits. And so what we're doing with this campaign is we're working to arm community members and schools with some of the resources for them to be able to make this transition themselves. So whether that's applying for the VW settlement money that came out of Dieselgate, whether that's other public funds, or a sort of really interesting solution that we're working with now is called inclusive financing and the pay-as-you-save model, where essentially the school districts partner with the local utility companies to offset those costs of transitioning to the electric buses. I know you made mention of Sacramento. One of our partners in Sacramento is the Twin Rivers Unified School District, and they're actually in a partnership with their local utility that helps cover some of the charging infrastructure, gives them a solid rate on their electricity consumption. And so we're really excited about that toolkit launching on Monday, because it'll be a way for, like you said, community members to really step-by-step figure out what are some of the things that they can do to start working towards some of those changes in their own towns and neighborhoods.
And talk about why this is so important, Michael. We just did a show about air pollution, and 9 million people die prematurely every year because of air pollution. This is invisible. Although, if you live near a refinery or if you live near a highway, a lot of people get regular headaches. They've got asthma. This can lead to all kinds of diseases like cancer, heart diseases, strokes. And this is a really important issue that deserves more attention. And I love this idea of electric school buses. So can you talk more just about how air pollution really affects these frontline communities?
Yeah, well, we know 25 million kids in the U.S. are riding a school bus, you know, on their way to get this education. And roughly, currently, 90% of those buses are operated on diesel. So we know that there's research showing that tailpipe pollution leads to problems focusing, lower IQ, decreased classroom performance in all kinds of different ways. And it's so funny, like you said, it's sort of an invisible thing. We had a writing workshop with some high school students who really weren't, you know, they in their minds, they didn't really see how this was connected to them. And then one of the students make mention, he's like, well, I know that I can't wear a white t-shirt to school anymore because by the end of the day, my t-shirt that started off nice, crispy, and white is a little bit dingy. And do you think that could be from the air? And that even the fact that, like, this student couldn't wear a white t-shirt and still be clean at the end of the day, that was their in. But it was a way to sort of show that often some of these issues, you know, it's hard to notice that they're happening. And frankly, the communities that are impacted most by these pollutants are often the ones who don't have the resources to invest in things like electric school bus infrastructure, aren't able to sort of elevate their concerns and raise their voices in a way that'll get the attention that maybe other communities can. And so we really felt that, you know, starting with school buses, it's something that, you know, if you're a child, if you're a parent, if you're a community member, many folks have sort of a touchstone to that. And we felt like it was the perfect way for us to get started. We know that it's the number one source of carbon emission in the U.S. We know that it's contributing to climate change, but on a very, like, real daily level, there's, you know, I can't tell you how many students and parents we've spoken to who are saying that, you know, in just one generation, multiple children have developed asthma. You know, the health bills that are coming for these students, kids, you know, being drowsy and kids having issues studying and focusing in the class. It's often something that, you know, can be written away for a lot of other reasons, but, you know, we're showing more and more research that's connecting this to their environment. And we felt that, you know, by folks engaging directly with their schools on these electric school buses, it's a way for folks to take an actionable step in their own community.
Where can people get information about the electric school buses and the campaign that's about to be launched?
Yeah, so if you check out fuelchangenow.com, that'll take you to the website that has all the information about the campaign. And like we mentioned, on Monday, this coming Monday, we'll be releasing our community action toolkit, which will be a way for folks to really get involved step by step, be connected with other folks around the country or who are concerned in doing the same. So they can head on over to fuelchangenow.com.
Great. Thank you. And that is Michael Estrada, Organizing Director at Green for All. We're also joined today by Gladys Limon, Executive Director of the California Environmental Justice Alliance. And on today's Your Call, we are continuing our week-long series on the climate crisis. Of course, we talk about these issues every Monday on the show, but we wanted to join the great worldwide journalism initiative called Covering Climate Now. And today we are talking about environmental justice. And if you'd like to join us, if you'd like to talk about some solutions at the top of your list, especially if you live in a frontline community, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Gladys, since we're talking about solutions, what one or two solutions is near the top of your list?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's difficult to narrow it down to one or two. I do just want to again, affirm that this is a health crisis, that those communities that have been at the front lines have had their life expectancy is being sacrificed, their physical well-being, their daily life activities. This is a crisis that needs to be addressed with urgency at that level. And now, of course, we have a global crisis as well in which we need to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions, which requires massive transformation of our policies and the way that we organize our lives. So while we need to create the good, such as, you know, electrifying transportation that Michael talked about, first and foremost in those communities that are most impacted by diesel and other transportation pollution, as well as ensure that renewable energy technology is making its way into, in a meaningful way, into low-income communities and communities of color. So there is a policy in California that CEHA and our partners and allies helped move called the Solar on Multifamily Affordable Housing program that invests $100 million a year for 10 years to ensure that solar rooftop technology is placed on multifamily, low-income multifamily housing, so that the technology is making its way there. There are decreases in air pollution, and that the economic savings are also reflected in tenants' electric bills. So while we're building the good in these communities, we also need to alleviate them of the bad, such as oil drilling that is happening in residential neighborhoods where families are raising their children literally next to an oil rig, and in drilling that is happening in refineries or in gas plants as well, for example. So there, as we are transitioning, we need to ensure that we are doing both of those things, investing, putting in the technology and renewable, clean, safe resources in the most impacted communities, as we also then remove those harmful sources of pollution and greenhouse gas emissions. We also need to make sure that those workers in these industries that will be impacted and transitioned out from those dirty jobs, that they are also meaningfully taken care of, that there is a serious investment to ensure that their livelihoods are transitioned into the clean energy economy, into jobs that have are unionized, that have livable wages, et cetera.
Also, Gladys, I wanted to talk about what's happening in Sacramento, because today is a big day for the California Environmental Justice Alliance and a number of environmental justice organizations. They're protesting outside of the California EPA in Sacramento today to speak out against the Tropical Forest Standard. Can you tell us, first off, what this is for those who are not familiar with it?
Sure. So the California Air Resource Board is today going to consider either adopting or rejecting a standard that the technical name is Criteria for Assessing Jurisdiction Scale Programs that Reduce Emissions from Tropical Deforestation, otherwise known as a proposed Tropical Forest Standard. So while we all agree that urgent efforts must be made to fight deforestation and the intention or premise of this proposal is laudable, this is a standard that is fundamentally flawed in that it will not ensure a reduction in greenhouse gas emissions and is very likely to perpetuate environmental injustices and human rights abuses abroad and in California. So what it is, it's strange in that it's not a policy that California would adopt, but it's a standard that would serve as a quasi foreign policy guidance that the state will put out into the world and lift as a golden standard for an offset program or an emissions trading scheme to protect against deforestation. But as written, the standard is significantly flawed and very weak, and we're concerned. We're working with SEHA and the coalition of a broad range of organizations are concerned that this proposed standard will unleash more problems that it intends to actually solve, and the state will not be accountable because there are no resources attached to the standard to monitor or ensure the integrity of the standard.
So if that's the case, where did this come from? Who's behind this?
Well, that's a very good question. We actually have a Public Records Act request hoping to get at some of at this question. There are a couple of groups that are behind, that are proponents of it, including the Environmental Defense Fund. And, you know, this policy has sort of languished around, or the standard has languished for a number of years. You know, I want to go to the merits of the standard. There are a number of reports out there and expert opinions that show that the unintended consequences of such a standard can lead to displacement of indigenous and other forest-dwelling communities, violating sovereignty rights and resulting in human rights abuses. And it's especially dangerous if you unleash something that's just, you know, vague and sounds great, but, you know, is really flawed and doesn't allow for enforcement. It's really dangerous, especially against state leaders such as Bolsonaro in Brazil, that may very well lead to placing further financial power from offset monies into his hands while imperiling the Amazon even further. And again, there's a body of research that shows that the most effective solutions to protect against deforestation are leaving these lands to be held and managed by indigenous peoples and local communities. And this is something the United Nations has recognized, and yet this proposed standard neglects a solution that is centered on respecting and valuing that knowledge and land management of indigenous communities.
The Los Angeles Times had a piece about this, and they report that the issue has really divided scientists, environmental groups, and indigenous leaders who talk about the ramifications of the Tropical Forest Standard. Some of the people who support it say it would fund community centers and support sustainable farming practices. So what are your thoughts on that?
Again, in theory, like the theory and the premise behind it is, it's fine, but this standard, as it's written, and as it will not be enforced, again, there are no financial resources attached to it, is very weak. It will not actually lead to, you know, those the expectations and what we would hope to achieve. So again, while we need serious solutions to this very serious problem, and this is not a sound policy. Again, we're concerned about the issues with indigenous sovereignty and displacement, and also with the fact that, you know, based on this well-documented history of failed international offset programs, that this standard may actually result in increased emissions, including here at home, particularly in those environmental justice communities at the front lines of refineries and other large emitters. who, again, who their health and safety have been sacrificed for too long. And in fact, there's a recent report that places into question the effectiveness of our domestic forest offset program, showing that its flawed design is leading to reductions on paper that are not real. So, you know, if we cannot successfully implement forest offset programs here and where there are resources to monitor and enforce, we cannot expect the Air Resources Board to be responsible. It doesn't have the experience, again, or the resources to ensure the integrity of foreign programs under this standard.
We're going to have to take a quick break. We're speaking with Gladys Limon, Executive Director of the California Environmental Justice Alliance. It's a statewide community-led alliance that works to achieve environmental justice by advancing policy solutions. Michael Estrada is Organizing Director at Green for All, an Oakland-based community organization that is fighting to build an inclusive green economy while creating green jobs for people living in poverty. And again, Michael talked about the electric school buses program earlier. This is a really important program, and you can find more information about it at fuelchangenow.com. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's toll-free, 866-798-8255. And you can also post a comment or question on the website at yourcallradio.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. When does an online joke go too far? Making a flash mob to Area 51 and more will be discussed at 11 o'clock at 1 here on 1A here on KALW 1/2 hour from now.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We will wrap up this week of climate crisis coverage by talking about the impact that this project has had. If you have some time, head over to Covering Climate Now on social media or even on the web. The sheer number of reports that have come out this week is just so impressive. There's been incredible reporting from around the world about such a wide range of issues. And so we'll talk about the impact that it has had on tomorrow's show. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. You can also listen to past shows and sign up for our podcast at yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about environmental justice and real solutions. And we're joined by Gladys Limon, Executive Director of the California Environmental Justice Alliance, and Michael Estrada, Organizing Director of Green for All. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. What does climate justice and environmental justice mean for you? When we're talking about demanding this for people on the front lines who have been speaking out on these issues for such a long time, what does that mean to you? What changes would you like to see? You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. We have an email from Mary who says, one possible solution for the crisis, the DOD, the Department of Defense, has identified climate change as a national threat. Why can't funds from the DOD budget be used to buy all citizens a small, modest electric vehicle? A huge WPA-style project could be set up to produce these low-cost cars. Otherwise, there's no way we will get the gas cars off the road. Regular folks cannot afford new cars. Funds could be found in other bloated government departments as well from hugely profitable fossil fuel multinationals. But the DOD is responsible for defending us, so start defending us. Well, Mary, imagine what the cost of an F-35 could do. I mean, it's a good point. Michael, what are your thoughts on this? I've been doing a lot of research on electric cars, and there are some that are, well, the lower, I guess it's around 20 grand, but I met someone the other day who leased an electric car for $150 a month. So it is really out of reach for a lot of people.
Yeah, I think that, again, like I mentioned earlier, I think a lot of times these green solutions that are upheld very publicly as answers and really great technology are often out of reach of the average person in this country. Forget buying a brand new electric vehicle. Like, I don't know very many people who have bought a brand new car in the past couple of years. And while there are, we've worked with a lot of groups that are doing great work around individual programs, to help inform community members on some of the cost-saving benefits if you are able to purchase one of these vehicles, programs that will help, subsidize purchasing the new vehicle or trading in older vehicles. But one of the things that we've seen is just, like, at scale, those kind of solutions are still a bit out of reach. And I think often it does start with industry and seeing where the overall cost of some of these vehicles and these technologies are driven down, making them more accessible, while at the same time making sure that when we do have the opportunities to, whether it be through policy, whether it be through public leverage, finding ways to make sure that the folks who are often left out of these solutions have access to them, whether it be through financial support, whether it be through issue education, and whether it be through policy and legislature.
Well, thank you for that email. Such an important point, Mary. We have another email from Howard who says, I live in Hunter's View, a residential development owned by the city on Hunter's Point. From my apartment, I see the Recology Collection Site, the notorious Shipyard Superfund Site, and working shipyards. In the streets around my building, we have no street cleaning and no trash cans on the sidewalks. Litter is scattered everywhere. Toxic cigarette butts jam the spaces between bricks on the sidewalk. Some buildings have solar panels, but not all. Nearby, both the 101 and the 280 freeways fly overhead, and a major sewage treatment plant covers a half dozen blocks at Evans and 3rd. The shoreline and floor of the bay here are poisonous. The neighborhood has a great history of fighting the old PG&E power plant, but in the 2 years living here, I have not heard of anything being done on these many fronts. What can I do? What resources are available? Gladys, would you take that one first?
Sure. Well, yeah, that is just atrocious that we have so many of these types of communities in California in 2019, again, where people's lives are being sacrificed and neglected. There are fortunately some new policies that do prioritize investments, state monies for disadvantaged communities, such as the TCC program, the Transformative Climate Communities program, that provides for applications that are jointly submitted by government jurisdictions and residents and resident groups to the state in order to receive large grants to address these sorts of problems, to increase services and environmental benefits for communities, and make efforts to decrease polluting sources and to mitigate them as well. So that's an example of the types of programs that we need to increasingly have in our state. Again, those that are prioritizing, that have equity at the center and prioritizing investments into the communities that have been neglected for far too long.
Michael, what would you add?
Yeah, I think that you touched on a lot of on sort of the policy, and I think specifically around that last point is just as whether it be organizations like ourselves or and like you all, whether it be businesses that are coming in, I think finding ways to be involved in the communities on a very deeper level. So it's not just popping in and to say that we're looking to capitalize off of the people that are here, but really investing in the needs and supporting the folks there. And I think it really starts going back to kind of the first point, is being able to just hear those voices and understand and sort of challenge the assumptions that come in, because I think oftentimes, even if you're coming from an area where you had a successful business or you had a successful program run, often every community has its own sort of context and its own nuance. And I think making sure that you invest the time, even before sort of the money is allocated, invest the time in the research of who are the leaders there, who are the people that we need to be speaking with to get a really good understanding of what's going to work to make this community thrive.
Well, thank you so much for writing in, Howard. And since you're writing in from Hunter's Point, I just want to give a shout out to Marie Harrison, an amazing environmental justice activist. in Hunters Point, who died on May 5th in Stockton at age 71 of chronic lung disease. We've had Marie on the show, and she did amazing work for her community. I also wanted to ask you both, since we're talking about some issues in California, California politicians, you know, love to say that this is the state of the resistance. They love to slam Donald Trump. In fact, the New York Times just reported that from the moment the Trump administration began saying it planned to revoke California's authority to set vehicle emission standards that were tougher than federal rules, which is obviously a horrible thing to do, Governor Gavin Newsom tweeted immediately, "See you in court." And so when it comes to federal policies and Donald Trump, the Democrats are right there taking this on. Gladys, how would you grade California Dems when it comes to working with people on front line, who are on the front lines dealing with just so much environmental injustice?
Mm-hmm. Well, we can't deny that California has been a critical leader of historically and currently, particularly with the federal administration that we currently have. And again, through a number of years and engagement efforts by environmental justice community residents and advocates, a number of elected officials have passed some very, very progressive policies that do center equity and environmental justice community. However, when it comes to any policies or efforts that would chip away at the profits of the fossil fuel industry, that is where we have the most challenges. That's where there is a lot of room for leadership and also with real transformative policies. So, for example, when it came to the extension of the cap and trade program, environmental justice and other advocates really pushed for a modification of the design of that program that would include direct emission reductions at the source in those environmental justice communities that would, in a very simple, straightforward way, both reduce emissions and also reduce that deadly pollution. And that was rejected. It was by legislators and former Governor Brown. And as a result, we have seen that with the extension of the cap and trade program, that emissions from those large emitters in frontline communities have actually increased, and along with that, pollution has increased. You know, we also lobbying and financial power of the fossil fuel industry just gets to elected officials too often. So, for just another example, in Southern California, the refineries fall within the South Coast Air Resources Air Quality Management District use a chemical called hydrofluoric acid, which is a deadly chemical. They use it in the form they call modified hydrofluoric acid, that at any point in some sort of like accident or leakage can be catastrophic miles from the center of those refineries. And in fact, in 2015 at the Torrance refinery, there was an explosion in which there was a near miss to a tank holding large amounts of hydrofluoric acid, which would have been absolutely catastrophic. So community organizations and residents have organized for years demanding that the South Coast Air Quality Management District eliminate and just prohibit that practice. And the staff of the district was recommending a proposal that was supported by environmental justice advocates that would have eliminated this practice. And sort of last minute, after some heavy lobbying from the industry, the board rejected the staff's recommendation and what residents had been asking for so long to protect their safety, and instead adopted a rule that puts these measures in the hands of the refineries themselves, and that it allows for voluntary increased safety measures and voluntary monitoring. So the very industry and, you know, bad actor that has been creating this problem and has been putting communities at risk is now left, to its own recourse to monitor itself. So again, this is just one example of many that shows that when it comes to protecting communities with real solutions that impact the operations of the fossil fuel industry, our elected officials just have not shown the courage or the leadership yet.
Hmm. Well, Gladys, I know we have to let you go, so thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for your work.
Thank you very much.
Gladys Limon is Executive Director of the California Environmental Justice Alliance. Michael Estrada is Organizing Director at Green for All. Same question to you, Michael. What are your thoughts about how Democrats in California deal with issues around environmental justice and injustice?
Yeah, well, I think it's one of the things that we've seen often is there will be specific cities and state legislatures that are making solid moves towards some of these goals. So if we're looking at California, they've pledged to have 100% fleet of electric buses. You know, by 2023, the large transit agencies are going to need to be buying electric buses at least 25% of the time. By 2026, it's going to hit 50, and by 2029, they're no longer going to be buying non-electric buses for their fleets. So these, we have seen some moves where they are making solid investments into some of these technologies and into prioritizing the health and the well-being of the citizens. But I definitely would agree that we're always having room to sort of sharpen the kind of language that we're including in these policies to make sure that they're prioritizing the folks that are hit first and worst by these pollutants and these different environmental factors. The California has been a leader on sort of many human rights issues, throughout the years. But it's one of the areas that, you know, as we continue to see policy growing on the national stage and seeing more and more of these underrepresented communities have their voices elevated, I think it's going to really be on California and whoever's in power on either side of the aisle to make sure that they're taking those things into account and really putting those into policy. You know, it's not enough to say we want to work with these folks. It's not enough to say that we're going to do our best to make sure that these resources reach them, but really of having that baked into the policies themselves and making sure that we're, you know, whether it be by air pollutant metrics, whether it be by income level, whether it be by various other factors to identify sort of what kind of resources are most needed in some of these communities. But I think having those things baked into the policies themselves is going to be one of the key ways that we're going to see long-lasting change, or at least on the systems level. Mm.
And again, that is Michael Estrada, Organizing Director with Green for All. And now I would like to welcome Teray Almaguer to the show. Teray is Poder's environmental justice organizer and has served in this role for over 15 years. Poder's mission is to organize with Latino immigrant families and youth to put into practice people-powered solutions that are locally based, community-led, and environmentally just. Hi, Teray. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi.
So, Teray, since you've been in this role for more than 15 years, I would just love to hear from you what you think about where we are right now, given that we're expecting over 1 million youth to take to the streets tomorrow, and environmental justice is at the top of so many people's minds and lists when we're talking about solutions today.
I mean, I think right now everybody's feeling the hurt that Mother Earth is going through. We're feeling it in the fires, we're feeling it in the droughts, we're feeling it in the hurricanes, we're feeling it in, we have been feeling it as environmental justice communities, because environmental racism has been prevalent since the establishment of this country. And the reality is that people of color, poor people of color, bear the brunt of this extractive economy. And because of that, we have cancers, we have asthmas, we have all kinds of health diseases disproportionately, right? And so I think that, it's that hurt and that pain and that suffering from all this disease caused from this extraction is being felt worldwide. Mm. And so people are standing up. Youth are taking a stand, and I think a lot of it has been led by communities of color doing grassroots organizing before there was even the environmental justice term coined in 1991. And so really grateful and thankful for all the environmental justice leaders previous to 91 that, you know, have been at the forefront of calling out corporations that are, you know, draining the blood of the earth, like they say when they talk about the oil, or dumping, all the dumping that we've been doing into the ocean, or, you know, just the different systems that have been created to just create a lot of waste, you know, really putting profit over people and over the planet.
Right. Yeah, it's so true. I mean, it's such an interesting time because, as you said, when you look at the pain that so many people are dealing with, the pain of the planet, losing species, what's happening in the Bahamas, the Amazon, I mean, there's so much what's happening in our own backyards. And then you look at all of the activism, which is just so inspiring. It's almost like we're being thrown with, there's so many emotions happening at one time. And how do you deal with that?
I mean, I think a lot of it is about finding outlets to put those emotions into action, right? Like today I'm here in Sacramento standing in solidarity with EJ communities, climate justice communities, with indigenous people from California to the Amazon, and really trying to create more of a awareness around some of the false solutions that are being shopped around by the market, by our state, right? There is a vote happening on the tropical forest standards, which, you know, passed, and they're trying to implement it even further and privatizing forests and separating indigenous people from their lands, from their ancestral lands. They have been stewards of those lands. They have taken care of those lands. Those forests are still there and beautiful and thriving because they have taken care of them, right? Yet, you know, if California wants to take those forests and say, we're going to use these as a way to offset our pollution. And in California, we're like, you know, tearing down trees left and right, you know, like, and not been very responsible at the amount of pollution that is being put into our communities. And so really looking at, like, what are the ways in which we could support indigenous sovereignty, indigenous leadership, indigenous stewardship, which has been at the forefront of taking care of Mother Earth and living in harmony with her, right? And so I think, you know, there's always something to do, and really looking at, like, how do we unite and organize together and be in harmony with each other to create that change that needs to happen.
Therese, since you are on the ground with so many activists and various organizations, can you just tell us what you're seeing? What are people saying? Because a lot of people flew in from all over the world to be there.
You know, I think, you know, we started off with the opening rally in the morning, and we had one of the sisters from the Amazon talk about, you know, how violating it feels to have these head of states, which is, you know, our California government or Newsom or the Air Resources Board, and then their heads of state that, you know, a lot of times are just like the U.S. has oppressed indigenous people on U.S. land, indigenous people are oppressed by the Brazilian government on their own land, making negotiations around their ancestral lands, right? Just the violation of that, right? And feeling like you're taking, you know, a part of me away because I am from this land. And so just a lot of love and hoping that if folks want to be supportive, you could send a message to the Air Resources Board. We're about to have the item up to be heard. It's item 19-8-6, and really saying no to the tropical forest standards proposal. Because we don't, it doesn't make sense for us to go up into Brazil and protect trees there when we can't even protect the trees in our own state of California. You know, what are we doing here for, you know, the different forest fires that have been happening and have been becoming, epidemic, right? Like, I mean, they're saying now that forest fire season is year round, and like the health effects that that's had on everybody affected, right?
Right.
And how are we not listening to California Native folks like the Pomo or who have talked about, you know, a part of, we live in a fire ecology, and a part of us being in relationship with the forest is doing our own burns and allowing for those trees to be reborn, to like, to, you know, they need fire, right? And so what are the ways in which we're taking leadership from indigenous people from California to the Amazon and all over the world? because they have a track record of knowing how to take care of Mother Earth. And we have to admit that as a capitalist society, we don't, you know, myself included, because I drive a car, I have a cell phone, I have all these things that like require a lot of extractivism from Mother Earth, which is ultimately causing a lot of the destruction, right? So how do we change those systems? What is our responsibility?
You make a great point, Teray. The Chronicle just a couple of days or weeks ago had a piece about how we all need to be preparing for the fires, how to protect yourself from the fires. So do it before it happens. I mean, this is our reality now in California and really across the country. Final thoughts from both of you. As more than a million people are expected to take to the streets tomorrow, as more than 250 media outlets are covering such a wide range of issues this week. I mean, these issues are now getting so much attention, and people on the front lines are really at the forefront. Michael, final thoughts on, environmental justice and what this really means. Did we lose Michael?
Oops, sorry about that.
That's okay.
Yeah, I would say that in all the work that folks are doing around the environment, I think it's just always important to remember that we work with and we center the folks that are most impacted by the effects of the climate crisis, making sure that we're bringing their voices into the space from the beginning, making sure that we're prioritizing them with solutions, and making sure that we're leveraging the resources that we have available to us for folks that aren't in those communities to make sure that we're doing what we can to support them, because the world is one ecosystem and we all interdepend on each other for these things to be long lasting. And so it's just going to be really important that we make sure we're learning from and listening to the folks that are dealing with this and have been dealing with this for many years.
And Teray, final thoughts from you, about 30 seconds.
I mean, I totally agree. We speak for ourselves is our environmental justice motto, right? And as Poder, working in San Francisco, we just opened up a farm 2 years ago and really reconnecting to our ancestral roots, growing our food, making our medicine from the plant, really learning about what it is to be connected to land and being a reflection of land, right? And I think interconnectedness is key, really looking to all the different amazing organizing networks that exist, the Climate Justice Alliance, the Environmental Indigenous Environmental Network, the California Environmental Justice Alliance. There is so much amazing work happening. You know, just connect to a local org. And it's really about working collectively together and acknowledging that interdependence and knowing that, you know, there's only one planet and we all need to organize and struggle to create that harmony that is needed for us to, you know, live long and good.
Teray, thank you so much for your work and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Teray Almaguer is Poder's environmental justice organizer. Poder's mission is to organize with Latino immigrant families and youth. And Michael, thank you for your work and thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Michael Estrada is organizing director at Green for All. And thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show and Kevin Vance, our studio engineer. You can find out more about the great work of our guest today at yourcallradio.org. And I hope you can join us tomorrow at our media roundtable. We will continue our week-long special on the climate crisis by talking about the impacts this project has had and where it is going from here. And then we will end tomorrow's show by talking about coverage of the United Auto Workers strike on Monday. 50,000 General Motors workers walked off the job. You can find more about Your Call, listen to past shows, and podcast the show at yourcallradio.org. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.